Silent Spring, Disc 5.
The Eastern Canadian situation is not unique, except perhaps in the extent of forest spraying and the wealth of facts that have been collected. Maine, too, has its salmon runs, a remnant to the magnificent runs of former days, but a remnant hard won by the work of biologists and conservationists to save some habitat for salmon in streams burdened with industrial pollution and choked with logs. Although spraying has been tried as a weapon against the ubiquitous budworm, the areas affected have been relatively small and have not as yet included important spawning streams for salmon. But what happened to stream fish in an area observed by the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Game is perhaps a portent of things to come. Immediately after the 1958 spraying, the department reported moribund suckers were observed in large numbers in Big Goddard Brook. These fish exhibited the typical symptoms of DDT poisoning. They swam erratically, gasped at the surface, and exhibited tremors and spasms. In the first 5 days after spraying, 668 dead suckers were collected from two blocking nets. Minnows and suckers were also killed in large numbers in Little Goddard, Carey, Alder, and Blake Brooks. Fish were often seen floating passively downstream in a weakened and moribund condition. In several instances, blind and dying trout were found floating passively downstream more than a week after spraying. The fact that DDT may cause blindness in fish is confirmed by various studies. A Canadian biologist who observed spraying on northern Vancouver Island in 1957 reported that cutthroat trout fingerlings could be picked out of the streams by hand, for the fish were moving sluggishly and made no attempt to escape. On examination, they were found to have an opaque white film covering the eye, indicating that vision had been impaired or destroyed. Laboratory studies by the Canadian Department of Fisheries showed that almost all fish, coho salmon, not actually killed by exposure to low concentrations of DDT, 3 parts per million, showed symptoms of blindness with marked opacity of the lens. Wherever there are great forests, modern methods of insect control threaten the fishes inhabiting the streams and the shelter of the trees. One of the best-known examples of fish destruction in the United States took place in 1955 as a result of spraying in and near Yellowstone National Park. By the fall of that year, so many dead fish had been found in the Yellowstone River that sportsmen and Montana Fish and Game administrators became alarmed. About 90 miles of the river were affected. In one 300-yard length of shoreline, 600 dead fish were counted, including brown trout, whitefish, and suckers. Stream insects, the natural food of trout, had disappeared. Forest Service officials declared that they had acted on advice that 1 pound of DDT to the acre was safe, but the results of the spraying should have been enough to convince anyone that the advice had been far from sound. A cooperative study was begun in 1956 by the Montana Fish and Game Department and two federal agencies, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service. Spraying in Montana that year covered 900,000 acres. 800,000 acres were also treated in 1957. The biologists, therefore, had no trouble finding areas for their study. Always the pattern of death assumed a characteristic shape. The smell of DDT over the forests, an oil film on the water surface, dead trout along the shoreline. All fish analyzed, whether taken alive or dead, had stored DDT in their tissues. As in eastern Canada, one of the most serious effects of spraying was the severe reduction of food organisms. On many study areas, aquatic insects and other stream bottom fauna were reduced to a tenth of their normal populations. Once destroyed, populations of these insects, so essential to the survival of trout, take a long time to rebuild. Even by the end of the second summer after spraying, only meager quantities of aquatic insects had reestablished themselves, and on one stream, formerly rich in bottom fauna, scarcely any could be found. In this particular stream, game fish had been reduced by 80%. The fish do not necessarily die immediately. In fact, delayed mortality may be more extensive than the immediate kill, and as the Montana biologists discovered, it may go unreported because it occurs after the fishing season. Many deaths occurred in the steady streams among autumn spawning fish, including brown trout, brook trout, and whitefish. This is not surprising because in time of physiological stress, the organism, be it fish or man, draws on stored fat for energy. This exposes it to the full lethal effect of the DDT stored in the tissues. It was therefore more than clear that spraying at the rate of a pound of DDT to the acre posed a serious threat to the fishes in forest streams. Moreover, control of the budworm had not been achieved, and many areas were scheduled for respraying. The Montana Fish and Game Department registered strong opposition to further spraying, saying it was not willing to compromise the sport fishery resource for programs of questionable necessity and doubtful success. The department declared, however, that it would continue to cooperate with the Forest Service in determining ways to minimize adverse effects. But can such cooperation actually succeed in saving the fish? An experience in British Columbia speaks volumes on this point. There, an outbreak of the black-headed budworm had been raging for several years. Forestry officials, fearing that another season's defoliation might result in severe loss of trees, decided to carry out control operations in 1957. There were many consultations with the Game Department, whose officials were concerned about the salmon runs. The Forest Biology Division agreed to modify the spraying program in every possible way short of destroying its effectiveness, in order to reduce risks to the fish. Despite these precautions, and despite the fact that a sincere effort was apparently made, in at least four major streams, almost 100% of the salmon were killed. In one of the rivers, the young of a run of 40,000 adult coho salmon were almost completely annihilated. So were the young stages of several thousand steelhead trout and other species of trout. The coho salmon has a three-year life cycle, and the runs are composed almost entirely of fish of a single age group. Like other species of salmon, the coho has a strong homing instinct returning to its natal stream. There will be no repopulation from other streams. This means, then, that every third year, the run of salmon into the river will be almost non-existent until such time as careful management by artificial propagation or other means has been able to rebuild this commercially important run. There are ways to solve this problem, to preserve the forests and to save the fishes, too. To assume that we must resign ourselves to turning our waterways into rivers of death is to follow the counsel of despair and defeatism. We must make wider use of alternative methods that are now known, and we must devote our ingenuity and resources to developing others. There are cases on record where natural parasitism has kept the budworm under control more effectively than spraying. Such natural control needs to be utilized to the fullest extent. There are possibilities of using less toxic sprays, or better still, of introducing microorganisms that will cause disease among the budworms without affecting the whole web of forest life. We shall see later what some of these alternative methods are and what they promise. Meanwhile, it is important to realize that chemical spraying of forest insects is neither the only way nor the best way. The pesticide threat to fishes may be divided into three parts. One, as we have seen, relates to the fishes of running streams and northern forests and to the single problem of forest spraying. It is confined almost entirely to the effects of DDT. Another is vast, sprawling, and diffuse, for it concerns the many different kinds of fishes, bass, sunfish, crappies, suckers, and others, that inhabit many kinds of waters, still or flowing, in many parts of the country. It also concerns almost the whole gamut of insecticides now in agricultural use, although a few principal offenders like Endrin, Toxaphene, Dieldrin, and Heptachlor can easily be picked out. Still another problem must now be considered largely in terms of what we may logically suppose will happen in the future, because the studies that will disclose the facts are only beginning to be made. This has to do with the fishes of salt marshes, bays, and estuaries. It was inevitable that serious destruction of fishes would follow the widespread use of the new organic pesticides. Fishes are almost fantastically sensitive to the chlorinated hydrocarbons that make up the bulk of modern insecticides. And when millions of tons of poisonous chemicals are applied to the surface of the land, it is inevitable that some of them will find their way into the ceaseless cycle of waters moving between land and sea. Reports of fish kills, some of disastrous proportions, have now become so common that the United States Public Health Service has set up an office to collect such reports from the states as an index of water pollution. This is a problem that concerns a great many people. Some 25 million Americans look to fishing as a major source of recreation, and another 15 million are at least casual anglers. These people spend $3 billion annually for licenses, tackle, boats, camping equipment, gasoline, and lodgings. Anything that deprives them of their sport will also reach out and affect a large number of economic interests. The commercial fisheries represent such an interest, and even more importantly, an essential source of food. Inland and coastal fisheries, excluding the offshore catch, yield an estimated 3 billion pounds a year. Yet, as we shall see, the invasion of streams, ponds, rivers, and bays by pesticides is now a threat to both recreational and commercial fishing. Examples of the destruction of fish by agricultural crop sprayings and dustings are everywhere to be found. In California, for example, the loss of some 60,000 game fish, mostly bluegill and other sunfish, followed an attempt to control the rice leaf miner with Dieldrin. In Louisiana, 30 or more instances of heavy fish mortality occurred in 1 year alone, 1960, because of the use of Endrin in the sugarcane fields. In Pennsylvania, fish have been killed in numbers by Endrin, used in orchards to combat mice. The use of chlordane for grasshopper control on the high western plains has been followed by the death of many stream fish. Probably no other agricultural program has been carried out on so large a scale as the dusting and spraying of millions of acres of land in southern United States to control the fire ant. Heptachlor, the chemical chiefly used, is only slightly less toxic to fish than DDT. Dieldrin, another fire ant poison, has a well-documented history of extreme hazard to all aquatic life. Only Endrin and Toxaphene represent a greater danger to fish. All areas within the fire ant control area, whether treated with Heptachlor or Dieldrin, reported disastrous effects on aquatic life. A few excerpts will give the flavor of the reports from biologists who studied the damage. From Texas: heavy loss of aquatic life despite efforts to protect canals. Dead fish were present in all treated water. Fish kill was heavy and continued for over 3 weeks. From Alabama: most adult fish were killed in Wilcox County within a few days after treatment. The fish in temporary waters and small tributary streams appeared to have been completely eradicated. In Louisiana, farmers complained of loss in farm ponds. Along one canal, more than 500 dead fish were seen floating or lying on the bank on a stretch of less than a quarter of a mile. In another parish, 150 dead sunfish could be found for every 4 that remained alive. 5 other species appeared to have been wiped out completely. In Florida, fish from ponds in a treated area were found to contain residues of Heptachlor and a derived chemical, Heptachlor epoxide. Included among these fish were sunfish and bass, which of course are favorites of anglers and commonly find their way to the dinner table. Yet the chemicals they contained are among those the Food and Drug Administration considers too dangerous for human consumption, even in minute quantities. So extensive were the reported kills of fish, frogs, and other life of the waters that the American Society of Ichthyologists and Herpetologists, a venerable scientific organization devoted to the study of fishes, reptiles, and amphibians, passed a resolution in 1958 calling on the Department of Agriculture and the associated state agencies to cease aerial distribution of heptachlore, dieldrin, and equivalent poisons before irreparable harm is done. The Society called attention to the great variety of species of fish and other forms of life inhabiting the southeastern part of the United States, including species that occur nowhere else in the world. Many of these animals, the Society warned, occupy only small areas and therefore might readily be completely exterminated. Fishes of the southern states have also suffered heavily from insecticides used against cotton insects. The summer of 1950 was a season of disaster in the cotton-growing country of northern Alabama. Before that year, only limited use had been made of organic insecticides for the control of the boll weevil. But in 1950, there were many weevils because of a series of mild winters, and so an estimated 80% to 95% of the farmers, on the urging of the county agents, turned to the use of insecticides. The chemical most popular with the farmers was toxaphene, one of the most destructive to fishes. Rains were frequent and heavy that summer. They washed the chemicals into the streams, and as this happened, the farmers applied more. An average acre of cotton that year received 63 pounds of toxaphene. Some farmers used as much as 200 pounds per acre. One, in an extraordinary excess of zeal, applied more than a quarter of a ton to the acre. The results could easily have been foreseen. What happened in Flint Creek, flowing through 50 miles of Alabama cotton country before emptying into Wheeler Reservoir, was typical of the region. On August 1st, torrents of rain descended on the Flint Creek watershed. In trickles, in rivulets, and finally in floods, the water poured off the land into the streams. The water level rose 6 inches in Flint Creek. By the next morning, it was obvious that a great deal more than rain had been carried into the stream. Fish swam about in aimless circles near the surface. Sometimes one would throw itself out of the water onto the bank. They could easily be caught. One farmer picked up several and took them to a spring-fed pool. There, in the pure water, these few recovered. But in the stream, dead fish floated down all day. This was but the prelude to more, for each rain washed more of the insecticide into the river, killing more fish. The rain of August 10th resulted in such a heavy fish kill throughout the river that few remained to become victims of the next surge of poison into the stream, which occurred on August 15th. But evidence of the deadly presence of the chemicals was obtained by placing test goldfish in cages in the river. They were dead within a day. The doomed fish of Flint Creek included large numbers of white crappies, a favorite among anglers. Dead bass and sunfish were also found, occurring abundantly in Wheeler Reservoir, into which the creek flows. All the rough fish population of these waters was destroyed also, the carp, buffalo, drum, gizzard shad, and catfish. None showed signs of disease, only the erratic movements of the dying and a strange, deep wine color of the gills. In the warm enclosed waters of farm ponds, conditions are very likely to be lethal for fish when insecticides are applied in the vicinity. As many examples show, the poison is carried in by rains and runoff from surrounding lands. Sometimes the ponds receive not only contaminated runoff, but also a direct dose as crop dusting pilots neglect to shut off the duster in passing over a pond. Even without such complications, normal agricultural use subjects fish to far heavier concentrations of chemicals than would be required to kill them. In other words, a marked reduction in the poundages used would hardly alter the lethal situation. For applications of over 0.1 pound per acre to the pond itself are generally considered hazardous. and the poison, once introduced, is hard to get rid of. One pond that had been treated with DDT to remove unwanted shiners remained so poisonous through repeated drainings and flushings that it killed 94% of the sunfish with which it was later stocked. Apparently, the chemical remained in the mud of the pond bottom. Conditions are evidently no better now than when the modern insecticides first came into use. The Oklahoma Wildlife Conservation Department stated in 1961 that reports of fish losses in farm ponds and small lakes had been coming in at the rate of at least one a week, and that such reports were increasing. The conditions usually responsible for these losses in Oklahoma were those made familiar by repetition over the years: the application of insecticides to crops, a heavy rain, and poison washed into the ponds. In some parts of the world, the cultivation of fish in ponds provides an indispensable source of food. In such places, the use of insecticides without regard for the effects on fish creates immediate problems. In Rhodesia, for example, the young of an important food fish, the kafue brim, are killed by exposure to only 0.04 parts per million of DDT in shallow pools. Even smaller doses of many other insecticides would be lethal. The shallow waters in which these fish live are favorable mosquito breeding places. The problem of controlling mosquitoes and at the same time conserving a fish important in the Central African diet has obviously not been solved satisfactorily. Milkfish farming in the Philippines, China, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, and India faces a similar problem. The milkfish is cultivated in shallow ponds along the coasts of these countries. Schools of young suddenly appear in the coastal waters from no one knows where and are scooped up and placed in impoundments where they complete their growth. So important is this fish as a source of animal protein for the rice-eating millions of Southeast Asia and India that the Pacific Science Congress has recommended an international effort to search for the now unknown spawning grounds in order to develop the farming of these fish on a massive scale. Yet spraying has been permitted to cause heavy losses in existing impoundments. In the Philippines, aerial spraying for mosquito control has cost pond owners dearly. In one such pond containing 120,000 milkfish, more than half of the fish died after a spray plane had passed over, in spite of desperate efforts by the owner to dilute the poison by flooding the pond. One of the most spectacular fish kills of recent years occurred in the Colorado River below Austin, Texas, in 1961. Shortly after daylight on Sunday morning, January 15th, dead fish appeared in the Newtown Lake in Austin and in the river for a distance of about 5 miles below the lake. None had been seen the day before. On Monday, there were reports of dead fish 50 miles downstream. By this time, it was clear that a wave of some poisonous substance was moving down in the river water. By January 21st, fish were being killed 100 miles downstream near LaGrange, and a week later, the chemicals were doing their lethal work 200 miles below Austin. During the last week of January, the locks on the intracoastal waterway were closed to exclude the toxic waters from Matagorda Bay and divert them into the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, investigators in Austin noticed an odor associated with the insecticides chlordane and toxaphene. It was especially strong in the discharge from one of the storm sewers. This sewer had in the past been associated with trouble from industrial wastes, and when officers of the Texas Game and Fish Commission followed it back from the lake, they noticed an odor like that of benzene hexachloride at all openings as far back as a feeder line from a chemical plant. Among the major products of this plant were DDT, benzene hexachloride, chlordane, and toxaphene, as well as smaller quantities of other insecticides. The manager of the plant admitted that quantities of powdered insecticide had been washed into the storm sewer recently, and more significantly, he acknowledged, that such disposal of insecticide spillage and residues had been common practice for the past 10 years. On searching further, the fishery officers found other plants where rains or ordinary cleanup waters would carry insecticides into the sewer. The fact that provided the final link in the chain, however, was the discovery that a few days before the water in the lake and river became lethal to fish, the entire storm sewer system had been flushed out with several million gallons of water under high pressure to clear it of debris. This flushing had undoubtedly released insecticides lodged in the accumulation of gravel, sand, and rubble and carried them into the lake and thence to the river, where chemical tests later established their presence. As the lethal mass drifted down the Colorado, it carried death before it. For 140 miles downstream from the lake, the kill of fish must have been almost complete, for when seines were used later in an effort to discover whether any fish had escaped, they came up empty. Dead fish of 27 species were observed, totaling about 1,000 pounds to a mile of riverbank. There were channel cats, the chief game fish of the river. There were blue and flathead catfish, bullheads, four species of sunfish, shiners, dace, stone rollers, largemouth bass, carp, mullet, suckers. There were eels, gar, carp, river carp suckers, gizzard shad, and buffalo. Among them were some of the patriarchs of the river, fish that by their size must have been of great age. Many flathead catfish weighing over 25 pounds, some of 60 pounds reportedly picked up by local residents along the river, and a giant blue catfish officially recorded as weighing 84 pounds. The Game and Fish Commission predicted that even without further pollution, the pattern of the fish population of the river would be altered for years. Some species, those existing at the limits of their natural range, might never be able to reestablish themselves, and others could do so only with the aid of extensive stocking operations by the state. This much of the Austin fish disaster is known, but there was almost certainly a sequel. The toxic river water was still possessed of its death-dealing power after passing more than 200 miles downstream. It was regarded as too dangerous to be admitted into the waters of Matagorda Bay with its oyster beds and shrimp fisheries, and so the whole toxic outflow was diverted to the waters of the open Gulf. What were its effects there? And what of the outflow of scores of other rivers carrying contaminants perhaps equally lethal? At present, our answers to these questions are for the most part only conjectures, but there is growing concern about the role of pesticide pollution in estuaries, salt marshes, bays, and other coastal waters. Not only do these areas receive the contaminated discharge of rivers, but all too commonly they are sprayed directly in efforts to control mosquitoes or other insects. Nowhere has the effect of pesticides on the life of salt marshes, estuaries, and all quiet inlets from the sea been more graphically demonstrated than on the eastern coast of Florida in the Indian River country. There in the spring of 1955, some 2,000 acres of salt marsh in St. Lucie County were treated with dieldrin in an attempt to eliminate the larvae of the sandfly. The concentration used was 1 pound of active ingredient to the acre. The effect on the life of the waters was catastrophic. Scientists from the Entomology Research Center of the State Board of Health surveyed the carnage after the spraying and reported that the fish kill was substantially complete. Everywhere, dead fishes littered the shores. From the air, sharks could be seen moving in, attracted by the helpless and dying fishes in the water. No species was spared. Among the dead were mullets, snook, mojarres, gambusia. The minimum immediate overall kill throughout the marshes, exclusive of the Indian River shoreline, was 20 to 30 tons of fishes, or about 1,175,000 fishes of at least 30 species, reported R.W. Harrington Jr. and W.L. Bidlingmeyer of the survey team. Mollusks seemed to be unharmed by dieldrin. Crustaceans were virtually exterminated throughout the area. The entire aquatic crab population was apparently destroyed, and the fiddler crabs, all but annihilated, survived temporarily only in patches of marsh evidently missed by the pellets. The larger game and food fishes succumbed most rapidly. Crabs set upon and destroyed the moribund fishes, but the next day were dead themselves. Snails continued to devour fish carcasses. After 2 weeks, no trace remained of the litter of dead fishes. The same melancholy picture was painted by the late Dr. Herbert R. Mills from his observations in Tampa Bay on the opposite coast of Florida, where the National Audubon Society operates a sanctuary for seabirds in the area including Whiskey Stump Key. The sanctuary, ironically, became a poor refuge after the local health authorities undertook a campaign to wipe out the salt marsh mosquitoes. Again, fishes and crabs were the principal victims. The fiddler crab, that small and picturesque crustacean whose hordes move over mudflats or sandflats like grazing cattle, has no defense against the sprayers. After successive sprayings during the summer and fall months, some areas were sprayed as many as 16 times. The state of the fiddler crabs was summed up by Dr. Mills. A progressive scarcity of fiddlers had by this time become apparent. Where there should have been in the neighborhood of 100,000 fiddlers under the tide and weather conditions of the day, October 12th, there were not over 100 which could be seen anywhere on the beach, and those were all dead or sick, quivering, twitching, and stumbling, scarcely able to crawl, although in neighboring unsprayed areas, fiddlers were plentiful. The place of the fiddler crab in the ecology of the world it inhabits is a necessary one, not easily filled. It is an important source of food for many animals. Coastal raccoons feed on them, so do marsh-inhabiting birds like the clapper rail, shorebirds, and even visiting seabirds. In one New Jersey salt marsh sprayed with DDT, the normal population of laughing gulls was decreased by 85% for several weeks, presumably because the birds could not find sufficient food after spraying. The marsh fiddlers are important in other ways as well, being useful scavengers and aerating the mud of the marshes by their extensive burrowings. They also furnish quantities of bait for fishermen. The fiddler crab is not the only creature of tidal marsh and estuary to be threatened by pesticides. Others of more obvious importance to man are endangered. The famous blue crab of the Chesapeake Bay and other Atlantic coast areas is an example. These crabs are so highly susceptible to insecticides that every spraying of creeks, ditches, and ponds in tidal marshes kills most of the crabs living there. Not only do the local crabs die, but others moving into a sprayed area from the sea succumb to the lingering poison. And sometimes poisoning may be indirect, as in the marshes near Indian River, where scavenger crabs attacked the dying fishes, but soon themselves succumbed to the poison. Less is known about the hazard to the lobster. However, it belongs to the same group of arthropods as the blue crab, has essentially the same physiology, and would presumably suffer the same effects. This would be true also of the stone crab and other crustaceans which have direct economic importance as human food. The inshore waters, the bays, the sounds, the river estuaries, the tidal marshes, form an ecological unit of the utmost importance. They are linked so intimately and indispensably with the lives of many fishes, mollusks, and crustaceans that were they no longer habitable, these seafoods would disappear from our tables. Even among fishes that range widely in coastal waters, many depend upon protected inshore areas to serve as nursery and feeding grounds for their young. Baby tarpon are abundant in all that labyrinth of mangrove-lined streams and canals bordering the lower third of the western coast of Florida. On the Atlantic coast, the sea trout, croaker, spot, and drum spawn on sandy shoals off the inlets between the islands or banks that lie like a protective chain off much of the coast south of New York. The young fish hatch and are carried through the inlets by the tides. In the bays and sounds, currituck, pamlico, bogue, and many others, they find abundant food and grow rapidly. Without these nursery areas of warm, protected, food-rich waters, the populations of these and many other species could not be maintained. Yet we are allowing pesticides to enter them via the rivers and by direct spraying over bordering marshlands. And the early stages of these fishes, even more than the adults, are especially susceptible to direct chemical poisoning. Shrimp, too, depend on inshore feeding grounds for their young. One abundant and widely ranging species supports the entire commercial fishery of the southern Atlantic and Gulf states. Although spawning occurs at sea, the young come into the estuaries and bays when a few weeks old to undergo successive molts and changes of form. There they remain from May or June until fall, feeding on the bottom detritus. In the entire period of their inshore life, the welfare of the shrimp populations and of the industry they support depends upon favorable conditions in the estuaries. Do pesticides represent a threat to the shrimp fisheries and to the supply for the markets? The answer may be contained in recent laboratory experiments carried out by the Bureau of Commercial Fisheries. The insecticide tolerance of young commercial shrimp just past larval life was found to be exceedingly low, measured in parts per billion instead of the more commonly used standard of parts per million. For example, half the shrimp in one experiment were killed by dieldrin at a concentration of only 15 parts per billion. Other chemicals were even more toxic. Endrin, always one of the most deadly of the pesticides, killed half the shrimp at a concentration of only half of one part per billion. The threat to oysters and clams is multiple. Again, the young stages are most vulnerable. These shellfish inhabit the bottoms of bays and sounds and tidal rivers from New England to Texas and sheltered areas of the Pacific coast. Although sedentary in adult life, they discharge their spawn into the sea, where the young are free living for a period of several weeks. On a summer day, a fine mesh tow net drawn behind a boat will collect, along with other drifting plants and animal life that make up the plankton, the infinitely small, fragile as glass, larvae of oysters and clams. No larger than grains of dust, these transparent larvae swim about in the surface waters, feeding on the microscopic plant life of the plankton. If the crop of minute sea vegetation fails, the young shellfish will starve. Yet pesticides may well destroy substantial quantities of plankton. Some of the herbicides in common use on lawns, cultivated fields, and roadsides, and even in coastal marshes, are extraordinarily toxic to the plant plankton, which the larval mollusks use as food, some at only a few parts per billion. The delicate larvae themselves are killed by very small quantities of many of the common insecticides. Even exposures to less than lethal quantities may in the end cause death of the larvae, for inevitably the growth rate is retarded. This prolongs the period the larvae must spend in the hazardous world of the plankton, and so decreases the chance they will live to adulthood. For adult mollusks, there is apparently less danger of direct poisoning, at least by some of the pesticides. This is not necessarily reassuring, however. Oysters and clams may concentrate these poisons in their digestive organs and other tissues. Both types of shellfish are normally eaten whole and sometimes raw. Dr. Philip Butler of the Bureau of Commercial Fisheries has pointed out an ominous parallel in that we may find ourselves in the same situation as the robins. The robins, he reminds us, did not die as a direct result of the spraying of DDT. They died because they had eaten earthworms that had already concentrated the pesticides in their tissues. Although the sudden death of thousands of fish or crustaceans in some stream or pond as the direct and visible effect of insect control is dramatic and alarming, these unseen and as yet largely unknown and unmeasurable effects of pesticides reaching estuaries indirectly in streams and rivers may in the end be more disastrous. The whole situation is beset with questions for which there are at present no satisfactory answers. We know that pesticides contained in runoff from farms and forests are now being carried to the sea in the waters of many and perhaps all of the major rivers. But we do not know the identity of all the chemicals or their total quantity, and we do not presently have any dependable tests for identifying them in highly diluted state once they have reached the sea. Although we know that the chemicals have almost certainly undergone change during the long period of transit, we do not know whether the altered chemical is more toxic than the original or less. Another almost unexplored area is the question of interactions between chemicals, a question that becomes especially urgent when they enter the marine environment where so many different minerals are subjected to mixing and transport. All of these questions urgently require the precise answers that only extensive research can provide, yet funds for such purposes are pitifully small. The fisheries of fresh and salt water are a resource of great importance, involving the interests and the welfare of a very large number of people. That they are now seriously threatened by the chemicals entering our waters can no longer be doubted. If we would divert to constructive research even a small fraction of the money spent each year on the development of ever more toxic sprays, we could find ways to use less dangerous materials and to keep poisons out of our waterways. When will the public become sufficiently aware of the facts to demand such action? Chapter 10. Indiscriminately from the skies. From small beginnings over farmlands and forests, the scope of aerial spraying has widened and its volume has increased, so that it has become what a British ecologist recently called an amazing rain of death upon the surface of the earth. Our attitude towards poisons has undergone a subtle change. Once they were kept in containers marked with skull and crossbones, the infrequent occasions of their use were marked with utmost care that they should come in contact with the target and with nothing else. With the development of the new organic insecticides and the abundance of surplus planes after the Second World War, all this was forgotten. Although today's poisons are more dangerous than any known before, they have amazingly become something to be showered down indiscriminately from the skies. Not only the target insect or plant, but anything, human or non-human, within range of the chemical fallout may know the sinister touch of the poison. Not only forests and cultivated fields are sprayed, but towns and cities as well. A good many people now have misgivings about the aerial distribution of lethal chemicals over millions of acres, and two mass spraying campaigns undertaken in the late 1950s have done much to increase these doubts. These were the campaigns against the gypsy moth in the northeastern states and the fire ant in the south. Neither is a native insect, but both have been in this country for many years without creating a situation calling for desperate measures. Yet drastic action was suddenly taken against them under the end justifies the means philosophy that has too long directed the control divisions of our Department of Agriculture. The gypsy moth program shows what a vast amount of damage can be done when reckless large-scale treatment is substituted for local and moderate control. The campaign against the fire ant is a prime example of a campaign based on gross exaggeration of the need for control, blunderingly launched, without scientific knowledge of the dosage of poison required to destroy the target or of its effects on other life. Neither program has achieved its goal. The gypsy moth, a native of Europe, has been in the United States for nearly 100 years. In 1869, a French scientist, Léopold Trouvelot, accidentally allowed a few of these moths to escape from his laboratory in Medford, Massachusetts, where he was attempting to cross them with silkworms. Little by little, the gypsy moth has spread throughout New England. The primary agent of its progressive spread is the wind. The larval or caterpillar stage is extremely light and can be carried to considerable heights and over great distances. Another means is the shipment of plants carrying the egg masses, the form in which the species exists over winter. The gypsy moth, which in its larval stage attacks the foliage of oak trees and a few other hardwoods for a few weeks each spring, now occurs in all the New England states. It also occurs sporadically in New Jersey, where it was introduced in 1911 on a shipment of spruce trees from Holland, and in Michigan, where its method of entry is not known. The New England hurricane of 1938 carried it into Pennsylvania and New York, but the Adirondacks have generally served as a barrier to its westward advance, being forested with species not attractive to it. The task of confining the gypsy moth to the northeastern corner of the country has been accomplished by a variety of methods, and in the nearly 100 years since its arrival on this continent, the fear that it would invade the great hardwood forests of the southern Appalachians has not been justified. 13 parasites and predators were imported from abroad and successfully established in New England. The Agriculture Department itself has credited these importations with appreciably reducing the frequency and destructiveness of gypsy moth outbreaks. This natural control, plus quarantine measures and local spraying, achieved what the department in 1955 described as outstanding restriction of distribution and damage. Yet only a year after expressing satisfaction with the state of affairs, its Plant Pest Control Division embarked on a program calling for the blanket spraying of several million acres a year, with the announced intention of eventually eradicating the gypsy moth. Eradication means the complete and final extinction or extermination of a species throughout its range. Yet as successive programs have failed, the department has found it necessary to speak of second or third eradications of the same species in the same area. The department's all-out chemical war on the gypsy moth began on an ambitious scale. In 1956, nearly a million acres were sprayed in the states of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Michigan, and New York. Many complaints of damage were made by people in the sprayed areas. Conservationists became increasingly disturbed as the pattern of spraying huge areas began to establish itself. When plans were announced for spraying 3 million acres in 1957, opposition became even stronger. State and federal agriculture officials characteristically shrugged off individual complaints as unimportant. The Long Island area, included within the gypsy moth spraying in 1957, consisted chiefly of heavily populated towns and suburbs, and of some coastal areas with bordering salt marsh. Nassau County, Long Island, is the most densely settled county in New York, apart from New York City itself. In what seems the height of absurdity, the threat of infestation of the New York City metropolitan area has been cited as an important justification of the program. The gypsy moth is a forest insect, certainly not an inhabitant of cities, nor does it live in meadows, cultivated fields, gardens, or marshes. Nevertheless, the planes hired by the United States Department of Agriculture and the New York Department of Agriculture and Markets in 1957 showered down the prescribed DDT and fuel oil with impartiality. They sprayed truck gardens and dairy farms, fish ponds and salt marshes. They sprayed the quarter-acre lots of suburbia, drenching a housewife making a desperate effort to cover her garden before the roaring plane reached her, and showering insecticide over children at play and commuters at railway stations. At Setauket, a fine quarter horse drank from a trough in a field which the planes had sprayed. 10 hours later, it was dead. Automobiles were spotted with the oily mixture. Flowers and shrubs were ruined. Birds, fish, crabs, and useful insects were killed. A group of Long Island citizens, led by the world-famous ornithologist Robert Cushman Murphy, had sought a court injunction to prevent the 1957 spraying. Denied a preliminary injunction, the protesting citizens had to suffer the prescribed drenching with DDT, but thereafter persisted in efforts to obtain a permanent injunction. But because the act had already been performed, the courts held that the petition for an injunction was moot. The case was carried all the way to the Supreme Court, which declined to hear it. Justice William O. Douglas, strongly dissenting from the decision not to review the case, held that the alarms that many experts and responsible officials have raised about the perils of DDT underline the public importance of this case. The suit brought by the Long Island citizens at least served to focus public attention on the growing trend to mass applications of insecticides, and on the power and inclination of the control agencies to disregard supposedly inviolate property rights of private citizens. The contamination of milk and of farm produce in the course of the gypsy moth spraying came as an unpleasant surprise to many people. What happened on the 200-acre Waller farm in northern Westchester County, New York, was revealing. Mrs. Waller had specifically requested agriculture officials not to spray her property because it would be impossible to avoid the pastures in spraying the woodlands. She offered to have the land checked for gypsy moths and to have any infestation destroyed by spot spraying. Although she was assured that no farms would be sprayed, her property received two direct sprayings and in addition was twice subjected to drifting spray. Milk samples taken from the Waller's purebred Guernsey cows 48 hours later contained DDT in the amount of 14 parts per million. Forage samples from fields where the cows had grazed were, of course, contaminated also. Although the county health department was notified, no instructions were given that the milk should not be marketed. This situation is unfortunately typical of the lack of consumer protection that is all too common. Although the Food and Drug Administration permits no residues of pesticides in milk, its restrictions are not only inadequately policed, but they apply solely to interstate shipments. State and county officials are under no compulsion to follow the federal pesticides tolerances unless local laws happen to conform, and they seldom do. Truck gardeners also suffered. Some leaf crops were so burned and spotted as to be unmarketable. Others carried heavy residues. A sample of peas analyzed at Cornell University's Agricultural Experiment Station contained 14 to 20 parts per million of DDT. The legal maximum is 7 parts per million. Growers, therefore, had to sustain heavy losses or find themselves in the position of selling produce carrying illegal residues. Some of them sought and collected damages. As the aerial spraying of DDT increased, so did the number of suits filed in the courts. Among them were suits brought by beekeepers in several areas of New York State. Even before the 1957 spraying, the beekeepers had suffered heavily from use of DDT in orchards. Up to 1953, I had regarded as gospel everything that emanated from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the agricultural colleges, one of them remarked bitterly. But in May of that year, this man lost 800 colonies after the state had sprayed a large area. So widespread and heavy was the loss that 14 other beekeepers joined him in suing the state for $250,000 in damages. Another beekeeper, whose 400 colonies were incidental targets of the 1957 spray, reported that 100% of the field force of bees, the workers out gathering nectar and pollen for the hives, had been killed in forested areas, and up to 50% in farming areas sprayed less intensively. "It is a very distressful thing," he wrote, "to walk into a yard in May and not hear a bee buzz." The gypsy moth programs were marked by many acts of irresponsibility. Because the spray planes were paid by the gallon rather than by the acre, there was no effort to be conservative, and many properties were sprayed not once but several times. Contracts for aerial spraying were in at least one case awarded to an out-of-state firm with no local address, which had not complied with the legal requirements of registering with state officials for the purpose of establishing legal responsibility. In this exceedingly slippery situation, citizens who suffered direct financial loss from damage to apple orchards or bees discovered there was no one to sue. After the disastrous 1957 spraying, the program was abruptly and drastically curtailed, with vague statements about evaluating previous work and testing alternative insecticides. Instead of the 3.5 million acres sprayed in 1957, the treated areas fell to 500,000 in 1958 and to about 100,000 acres in 1959, 1960, and 1961. During this interval, the control agencies must have found news from Long Island disquieting. The gypsy moth had reappeared there in numbers. The expensive spraying operation that had cost the department dearly in public confidence and goodwill, the operation that was intended to wipe out the gypsy moth forever, had in reality accomplished nothing at all. Meanwhile, the department's plant pest control men had temporarily forgotten gypsy moths, for they had been busy launching an even more ambitious program in the South. The word eradication still came easily from the department's mimeograph machines. This time the press releases were promising the eradication of the fire ant. The fire ant, an insect named for its fiery sting, seems to have entered the United States from South America by way of the port of Mobile, Alabama, where it was discovered shortly after the end of the First World War. By 1928, it had spread into the suburbs of Mobile and thereafter continued an invasion that has now carried it into most of the southern states. During most of the 40-odd years since its arrival in the United States, the fire ant seems to have attracted little attention. The states where it was most abundant considered it a nuisance, chiefly because it builds large nests or mounds a foot or more high. These may hamper the operation of farm machinery. But only two states listed it among their 20 most important insect pests, and these placed it near the bottom of the list. No official or private concern seems to have been felt about the fire ant as a menace to crops or livestock. With the development of chemicals of broad lethal powers, there came a sudden change in the official attitude toward the fire ant. In 1957, the United States Department of Agriculture launched one of the most remarkable publicity campaigns in its history. The fire ant suddenly became the target of a barrage of government releases, motion pictures, and government-inspired stories, portraying it as a despoiler of southern agriculture and a killer of birds, livestock, and man. A mighty campaign was announced in which the federal government, in cooperation with the afflicted states, would ultimately treat some 20 million acres in 9 southern states. United States pesticide makers appear to have tapped a sales bonanza in the increasing numbers of broad-scale pest elimination programs conducted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, cheerfully reported one trade journal in 1958, as the fire ant program got underway. Never has any pesticide program been so thoroughly and deservedly damned by practically everyone except the beneficiaries of this sales bonanza. It is an outstanding example of an ill-conceived, badly executed, and thoroughly detrimental experiment in the mass control of insects. An experiment so expensive in dollars, in destruction of animal life, and in loss of public confidence in the Agriculture Department, that it is incomprehensible that any fund should still be devoted to it. Congressional support of the project was initially won by representations that were later discredited. The fire ant was pictured as a serious threat to southern agriculture through destruction of crops, and to wildlife because of attacks on the young of ground-nesting birds. Its sting was said to make it a serious menace to human health. Just how sound were these claims? The statements made by department witnesses seeking appropriations were not in accord with those contained in key publications of the Agriculture Department. The 1957 bulletin, Insecticide Recommendations for the Control of Insects Attacking Crops and Livestock, did not so much as mention the fire ant. An extraordinary omission if the department believes its own propaganda. Moreover, its encyclopedic yearbook for 1952, which was devoted to insects, contained only one short paragraph on the fire ant out of its 500,000 words of text. Against the department's undocumented claims that the fire ant destroys crops and attacks livestock is the careful study of the Agricultural Experiment Station in the state that has had the most intimate experience with the insect, Alabama. According to Alabama scientists, damage to plants in general is rare. Dr. F.S. Arant, an entomologist at the Alabama Polytechnic Institute and in 1961 president of the Entomological Society of America, states that his department has not received a single report of damage to plants by ants in the past 5 years. No damage to livestock has been observed. These men who have actually observed the ants in the field and in the laboratory say that the fire ants feed chiefly on a variety of other insects, many of them considered harmful to man's interests. Fire ants have been observed picking larvae of the boll weevil off cotton. Their mound-building activities serve a useful purpose in aerating and draining the soil. The Alabama studies have been substantiated by investigations at the Mississippi State University, and are far more impressive than the Agriculture Department's evidence, apparently based either on conversations with farmers who may easily mistake one ant for another, or on old research. Some entomologists believe that the ants' food habits have changed as it has become more abundant, so that the observations made several decades ago have little value now. The claim that the ant is a menace to health and life also bears considerable modification. The Agriculture Department sponsored a propaganda film to gain support for its program, in which horror scenes were built around the fire ant's sting. Admittedly, this is painful, and one is well advised to avoid being stung, just as one ordinarily avoids the sting of wasp or bee. Severe reactions may occasionally occur in sensitive individuals, and medical literature records one death possibly, though not definitely, attributable to fire ant venom. In contrast to this, the Office of Vital Statistics records 33 deaths in 1959 alone from the sting of bees and wasps. Yet no one seems to have proposed eradicating these insects. Again, local evidence is most convincing. Although the fire ant has inhabited Alabama for 40 years and is most heavily concentrated there, the Alabama State Health Officer declares that there has never been recorded in Alabama a human death resulting from the bites of imported fire ants, and considers the medical cases resulting from the bites of fire ants incidental. Ant mounds on lawns or playgrounds may create a situation where children are likely to be stung, but this is hardly an excuse for drenching millions of acres with poisons. These situations can easily be handled by individual treatment of the mounds. Damage to game birds was also alleged without supporting evidence. Certainly a man well qualified to speak on this issue is the leader of the Wildlife Research Unit at Auburn, Alabama, Dr. Maurice F. Baker, who has had many years' experience in the area. But Dr. Baker's opinion is directly opposite to the claims of the Agriculture Department. He declares, in South Alabama and Northwest Florida, we are able to have excellent hunting, and bobwhite populations coexist with heavy populations of the imported fire ant. In the almost 40 years that South Alabama has had the fire ant, game populations have shown a steady and very substantial increase. Certainly, if the imported fire ant were a serious menace to wildlife, these conditions could not exist. What would happen to wildlife as a result of the insecticide used against the ants was another matter. The chemicals to be used were dieldrin and heptachlor, both relatively new. There was little experience of field use for either, and no one knew what their effects would be on wild birds, fishes, or mammals when applied on a massive scale. It was known, however, that both poisons were many times more toxic than DDT, which had been used by that time for approximately a decade and had killed some birds and many fish, even at a rate of £1 per acre. And the dosage of Dieldrin and heptachlor was heavier, £2 to the acre under most conditions, or £3 of Dieldrin if the white-fringed beetle was also to be controlled. In terms of their effects on birds, the prescribed use of heptachlor would be equivalent to £20 of DDT to the acre, that of Dieldrin to £120. Urgent protests were made by most of the state conservation departments, by national conservation agencies, and by ecologists, and even by some entomologists, calling upon the then Secretary of Agriculture, Ezra Benson, to delay the program at least until some research had been done to determine the effects of heptachlor and Dieldrin on wild and domestic animals, and to find the minimum amount that would control the ants. The protests were ignored, and the program was launched in 1958. 1 million acres were treated the first year. It was clear that any research would be in the nature of a post-mortem. As the program continued, facts began to accumulate from studies made by biologists of state and federal wildlife agencies and several universities. The studies revealed losses running all the way up to complete destruction of wildlife on some of the treated areas. Poultry, livestock, and pets were also killed. The Agriculture Department brushed away all evidence of damage as exaggerated and misleading. The facts, however, continue to accumulate. In Hardin County, Texas, for example, opossums, armadillos, and an abundant raccoon population virtually disappeared after the chemical was laid down. Even the second autumn after treatment, these animals were scarce. The few raccoons then found in the area carried residues of the chemical in their tissues. Dead birds found in the treated areas had absorbed or swallowed the poisons used against the fire ants, a fact clearly shown by chemical analysis of their tissues. The only bird surviving in any numbers was the house sparrow, which in other areas too had given some evidence that it may be relatively immune. On a tract in Alabama treated in 1959, half of the birds were killed. Species that live on the ground or frequent low vegetation suffered 100% mortality. Even a year after treatment, a spring die-off of songbirds occurred, and much good nesting territory lay silent and unoccupied. In Texas, dead blackbirds, dick sissels, and meadowlarks were found at the nests, and many nests were deserted. When specimens of dead birds from Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida were sent to the Fish and Wildlife Service for analysis, more than 90% were found to contain residues of Dieldrin or a form of heptachlor in amounts up to 38 parts per million. Woodcocks, which winter in Louisiana but breed in the north, now carry the taint of the fire ant poisons in their bodies. The source of this contamination is clear. Woodcocks feed heavily on earthworms, which they probe for with their long bills. Surviving worms in Louisiana were found to have as much as 20 parts per million of heptachlor in their tissues, 6 to 10 months after treatment of the area. A year later, they had up to 10 parts per million. The consequences of the sublethal poisoning of the woodcock are now seen in a marked decline in the proportion of young birds to adults, first observed in the season after fire ant treatments began. Some of the most upsetting news for southern sportsmen concerned the bobwhite quail. This bird, a ground nester and forager, was all but eliminated on treated areas. In Alabama, for example, biologists of the Alabama Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit conducted a preliminary census of the quail population in a 3,600-acre area that was scheduled for treatment. 13 resident coveys, 121 quail, ranged over the area. 2 weeks after treatment, only dead quail could be found. All specimens sent to the Fish and Wildlife Service for analysis were found to contain insecticides in amounts sufficient to cause their death. The Alabama findings were duplicated in Texas, where a 2,500-acre area treated with heptachlor lost all of its quail. Along with the quail went 90% of the songbirds. Again, analysis revealed the presence of heptachlor in the tissues of dead birds. In addition to quail, while turkeys were seriously reduced by the fire ant program. Although 80 turkeys had been counted on an area in Wilcox County, Alabama, before heptachlor was applied, none could be found the summer after treatment. None, that is, except a clutch of unhatched eggs and one dead poult. The wild turkeys may have suffered the same fate as their domestic brethren, for turkeys on farms in the area treated with chemicals also produced few young. Few eggs hatched, and almost no young survived. This did not happen on nearby untreated areas. The fate of the turkeys was by no means unique. One of the most widely known and respected wildlife biologists in the country, Dr. Clarence Cottom, called on some of the farmers whose property had been treated. Besides remarking that all the little tree birds seemed to have disappeared after the land had been treated, most of these people reported losses of livestock, poultry, and household pets. One man was irate against the control workers, Dr. Cottom reported, as he said he buried or otherwise disposed of 19 carcasses of his cows that had been killed by the poison, and he knew of 3 or 4 additional cows that had died as a result of the same treatment. Calves died that had been given only milk since birth. The people Dr. Cottom interviewed were puzzled by what had happened in the months following the treatment of their land. One woman told him she had set several hens after the surrounding land had been covered with poison, and for reasons she did not understand, very few young were hatched or survived. Another farmer raises hogs, and for fully 9 months after the broadcast of poisons, he could raise no young pigs. The litters were born dead, or they died after birth. A similar report came from another who said that out of 37 litters that might have numbered as many as 250 young, only 31 little pigs survived. This man had also been quite unable to raise chickens since the land was poisoned.
This ends Disc 5.